open with each other about our goals from the very beginning. So we were definitely both on the same page. As far as the timing, I don't think either of us was prepared for things to happen as quickly as they did. After all, I'm the ultimate planner and usually need things nailed down to the very last detail, which is not exactly how nature operates, but I'm so glad it did happen when it did. First of all, I think it's really easy to put things off and think you have all the time in the world, but I'm 33. If I waited for everything in my life to be perfect, I'd probably be 75 before I got around to having kids. But luckily, by conceiving when I did, I was able to be pregnant during the COVID quarantine and then have the baby as the world was opening up just a little bit. I wouldn't have changed this non-plan plan for the world. What's your life like together today? Our daily life is a lot like our proposal story, actually. We're a lot more normal than people realize. I think there's probably this misconception about Christian that he's a label-loving rich dude, a la Mr. Valentino, but he's actually the opposite. He doesn't care about flexing brand names whatsoever. I've bought him so many clothes and shoes, but he just wears the same simple outfits over and over. Honestly, if you saw him walking down the street, you'd never guess he had a dime to his name. Legitimately, he doesn't care about material things. But we do share a love of travel. And not just that. 5-star travel places like St. Barts, Bali, Bora Bora, and the Maldives. When we're not traveling, we are total home buddies. We'll just sit by the pool, take a bath, read books, and just talk. Even before we were a boring married couple, we were a boring married couple. If we can spend a night at home nerding out, we'll do that over a night out almost every time. We talk about everything together. On any given day, you can find us discussing politics or philosophy. We don't actually like going out to dinner, so we'll order in from Mastro's, this fabulous steakhouse where we had our first date. We love good food, but we prefer to eat in our robes at home where we can be truly comfortable. Nearly every night before we go to bed, we read together. Sometimes he reads out loud to me, which is really sweet. We read all of Lauren Weisberger's books together, and lately, lots of baby sleep training books. I'm so excited to watch Baby C grow up and continue bonding with my husband. Christian is already talking about everything he's going to teach our son on the computer. At this rate, Baby C is probably going to be hacking into the Pentagon by preschool. I love that Christian and I are opposites in many ways, and I have the fabulous elements of my life to enjoy, and a husband who I love and relate to on a deep level at home with me every night. And I know that you can find the same for yourself too. Chapter 6. Get Rich AF. To be a boss bitch is to completely own your power. And if there's one thing that gives you more control than pretty much all of the other factors we've talked about in this book combined, it's money. Money is power. It's the ability to make your own choices, go where you want, when you want, walk out of a job that sucks, walk away from a relationship that sucks, and treat yourself whenever and however you want. There's a reason why they call cash in the bank fuck you money. The minute I started getting smart about my finances was the moment I finally got into the driver's seat of my life. And bitch, you know that if I'm gonna drive, then the whip's gonna be full on European luxury. That's why I wanted to dedicate a chapter to the cold, hard currency that makes this world go round. If you're gonna be a boss bitch, then you have to get comfortable with money. How to save it, how to spend it, how to know your worth, and how to get all around what's yours. But what if I just wanna marry rich, you say? Okay, I see you. We'll also cover how to sugar daddy responsibly because I have the expert playbook for that too. But spoiler alert, you still need to have your finances locked down because nothing spells disaster for a boss bitch more than having to beg daddy for every last dime. People assume that I came from a rich family, but call me Iggy Azalea because I started from the bottom and now I'm here. I didn't grow up in complete poverty, but my family had such a lack mindset. My mom scrimped and saved for everything. Either she made our clothes or we'd get them secondhand, and she was the coupon clipping master. She could stretch leftovers for an entire week. And just how she parented from a place of no, that's how she approached life's small indulgences too. It was always, we don't have the money to go to dinner. We can't do this. We can't do that. My parents were always talking about things that they didn't have. If we didn't have a coupon for it, it pretty much didn't happen. And it would drive me batty. I knew that I never wanted to live under the ultra-conservative life that my parents did. But when it came to money, it was more than just a lifestyle choice. The issue here wasn't about not having enough, because sometimes you do have to make tough choices in order to make ends meet, and that's just how it is. I wasn't upset with them about the fact that our clothes were never new or that we really never went on vacations, although I certainly dreamed of a life where I could do anything I wanted to. No, for me, the problem was their views about money was just an extension of how they were hiding from the world. As I saw it, money was freedom. But they were squandering every last bit they had. They were too afraid to see that if they spent $30 once a month on a meal that we could all share and enjoy, it wouldn't be the difference between paying our mortgage and being homeless. They had embraced the antiquated mentality that you save and you save and you save and then you die. And to me, that wasn't living. So from the time I was young, I started to get the idea that if I just changed my mindset about money, I could live more richly. Around the time I started thinking about these things, I became friends with Amanda. Amanda was the chick that I was telling you about a few chapters ago. She was a fellow loser like me, so the two of us hit it off. And our moms were friends, so I was actually allowed to hang out with her. And sometimes, on special occasions, I'd get to sleep at her house. I love spending time with Amanda because in addition to knowing what it was like to be bullied by a bunch of high school assholes, she was also fucking loaded. As I mentioned before, her dad was the CEO of Radio Shack, so that girl wanted for nothing. She was like Blair Waldorf. Well, one time when my mom was in the hospital, I was sent to stay at Amanda's house for an entire week, which under normal circumstances would never have been permitted. To make it an even bigger deal, during that time, her dad was going on a business trip to New York, and Amanda and her mom were planning to go with him. And somehow, miraculously, my parents said that I could go. We stayed at this gorgeous hotel with a big glass staircase that I can still picture so clearly because it made such an impression on me. And Amanda and I had an enormous suite all to ourselves. We were zipping in and out of department stores like Bergdorf Goodman, Barney's, and Bendel's, where Amanda's mom told us that we could get anything we wanted. It was crazy to me at the time. Being able to pick out a $37 Chanel lip gloss, like, who would pay that much for that? Unfortunately, me now, on the regular. Her parents got us a reservation at Britney Spears' brand new restaurant, Nyla, and then let us take our own limo around the city. We were 16 years old, drinking champagne, hanging our heads out of the sunroof as we sang Britney Spears songs at the top of our lungs, living our best fucking lives. It was one thing for me to have seen this kind of wealth in my hometown in Texas, but here in the bustle of New York, watching all these women on the sidewalk just turned out and looking amazing with their fresh Sally Hershberger blowouts and Miuccia Prada knee-high crocodile boots, it was completely eye-opening for me. I'd never experienced this kind of luxury and glamour firsthand, and it was everything I wanted when I grew up. I thought, I don't know how, and I don't care how, but one day I'm going to have all this. My eyes were now completely open to the fact that if I was going to stay trapped in my parents' house doing my best Rapunzel impression, then I was never going to get anywhere. And the key to unlocking that door was money. Then and there, I knew that if I was going to start building the life that I wanted and knew that I deserved, I was going to have to go out and start making my own money. At first, that meant taking any job I could get. In my case, places like Sonic and Taco Bell. I didn't get too hung up on the fact that these weren't the be-all and end-all of jobs. They paid well enough. And because I was living with my parents, I could save everything that I made. I may have disagreed with my dad about a lot of things, but I always respected him because he's very, very smart. And the one thing he always drilled into me was how important it is to save. Specifically, he told me to save a minimum of 20% of my paycheck. So every single paycheck that came in, 20% of it would go into savings, and the other 80% I could spend on whatever I wanted. But as tempting as it was to go out and blow all that money on clothes, it was more important to me to build a safety net for the day that I would eventually move out. The only thing I wanted more than to leave was to not have to come back a failure. I wanted to prove to my parents that I wasn't a fuck up. So even when I was pursuing my dream job of becoming an actress or a model, I always had another job that could pay the bills. Eventually, I got a job at a bar, which was another fantasy of mine because I always wanted to be a bartender like you see in the movies. The sassy, doesn't-give-a-fuck bitch who runs the place, makes drink orders with one hand, and rips a shot of whiskey coyote ugly style with the other. I also knew that they made a lot of money. So, I doctored my resume. We're talking worthy of an honorary MD. Lied about my age, because Texas was the Wild West back then, and employers didn't ask you for jack shit when you applied for a job. And got the gig. I'd be making cash hourly and then my tips. Well, my first night, I made about $300. I was making that at Sonic in a week. It was a lot of fucking money. But also, I worked hard for it. It wasn't like I sat back and hoped to make 20% of the bar tab. No, I'd be out there chatting people up, being their therapist, having fun with them. I knew that acting would come in handy in business, trying out characters and all that, and it was especially true with bartending. When I saw it literally pay off in my first paycheck, it instantly clicked. I was in control of this ride. After years and years of feeling like I had no power at all, this was one of the moments that made me realize that I really did have the ability to go out into the world and make my own way with what eventually became my signature boss bitch hustle. And not only that, whatever cash I did manage to make was my ticket to anywhere that I wanted to go. And I set my sights on the tippy fucking top. People ask me all the time why I still work even though I married a wealthy man. It's because I get so much satisfaction about being able to do things for myself. This is what I worked so hard to achieve. Being able to work on my own terms, do my own thing, and know that I can always fend for myself. Plus, the extra spending money, aka Sephora credits, doesn't hurt either. I have a strong work ethic, not something I was born with, but something that I acquired over time, as you can too, and feel fulfilled and whole when I'm doing something that I feel passionate about. So I love working, and I always will. But mostly, I think there's something so powerful about not needing a man, but choosing to have one. Because as smart as I'd been with money my whole life, I'd found a habit of putting myself in situations where I needed to rely on someone else, and I never wanted to feel that way again. Take Mr. Valentino. My life with him was straight off my manifestation board. The Louboutins, the clothes, the fabulous trips on the Gulf Streams. But he wanted me to quit my job at the bar. At first, I was hesitant to do it. I learned how incredibly freeing it was to be making my own money. And while it wasn't as though I was making millions, I'd be lucky to make $2,000 a month. And that was still $2,000 a month that was completely mine. But he was persistent, and his bank account was abundant. And then he got more and more manipulative. He'd say things like, "I'd really like to take you on this trip, but I guess you'll have to check with work first." Or, "We could travel so much more if you just quit." He appealed to the side of me that wanted to be taken care of, which, I mean, don't we all? And I didn't have the balls to deny him that. I also conveniently ignored the red flag that the relationship probably wouldn't have worked out if I kept that job. And so even though I had this gorgeous man and I was living in his gorgeous house and leading this first-class, super elite, luxe life, I was missing the most important thing, freedom. According to him, my friends were never good enough. He would tell me how they were all such losers, that he didn't know why I hung out with them, and that it was honestly just embarrassing for me to be seen with them. Slowly, my girls' nights, my acting classes, my hobbies, my time with my family and my friends faded away. And it wasn't because they were losers. These people were vibrant and confident. He just wanted to phase everyone out of my life. If I wanted to do something or buy something, he'd insist on coming with me. To go to dinner with my friends, the grocery store, to get a fucking cup of coffee at Starbucks, he'd have to come because he'd given me an ultimatum. I go or you don't get the cash. I'd try pushing back, telling him that he couldn't just be my walking pocketbook. But because I thought that I needed him more than I needed my independence, I didn't want to push him too far and risk losing him. It was a classic power of the pussy teachable moment. I was afraid to ask, so I got nothing. And I definitely hadn't figured out my worth. When I eventually broke up with him, I knew that I would never, ever put myself in a position like that again. This chapter is the product of all the lessons that I learned in order to create full-on financial independence for myself. So while I may not be some kind of financial expert with a briefcase and fancy letters after my name, I can tell you with no hesitation that just a few simple tools and rules of thumb are to credit for my success. The beauty of these tools is that they're available to anyone, anytime, at any age, in any tax bracket. It doesn't matter if you work 3 jobs to make ends meet or if you're a hedge fund power bitch. The same rules apply and the same rules will pay off. If money is the passport to get the life you want, then no matter what that may look like, a combination of hustle, common sense, and keeping your eyes on the motherfucking prize is going to get you rich AF. Let's go make it rain, bitches. How to save. People are always asking me how I made all my money. Besides being a certified hustler, I'd have to say that the number one secret is learning how to save. I know that when you heard this chapter about getting rich, you were hoping for some kind of map across the rainbow to the pot of gold. But I can promise you that if you learn how to save, then you can make your money work double time, no matter how much or how little you make. Although I do think there's always room for improvement in the income department, but we'll get to that in a moment. As I mentioned earlier, saving a piece of my paycheck every single time is a lesson I learned from my dad. From my first job at Sonic, I made a habit of setting aside 20% of anything I earned, minimum. I know it sounds stupid simple, but so many people get a paycheck for $2,000 and think they have $2,000. But you don't. You have rent, utilities, car payments, gas, groceries, all that fun stuff. So there's income and then there's discretionary income, or the amount that's left over after you've taken out everything else that needs to be paid or your ass is on the street. As I made more money as a model, actress, and eventually as a real estate agent, that 20% was still consistently getting set aside. Sometimes it would be more if I was feeling extra mature or saving up for a specific goal like a new car or a bigger apartment, but never, ever less. In hindsight, I wish I had regularly upped that amount to 30 or even 40% and made myself more money. Especially after I started investing, which we'll talk about in just a sec. But when you work hard, you want to spend some of that 80% on yourself. So you know what? YOLO! Though, like I said, that 20% is non-negotiable. So no matter what you do, don't skimp on that. Get bitchy. Something that helped me keep track of my finances, especially when I was just starting to earn money, was to write everything down. First of all, that's because I'm very visual, and seeing things on paper feels so much more real to me. It's why I don't do anything on my phone. I keep track of everything in my agenda or write it in a journal. I mean, I still mail out checks. When I write down actual specific dollar amounts, I can see the cold, hard facts about what I need to save for and exactly how much money I have. It's a lot harder to play games when the numbers are staring you in the face. This exercise is the perfect combo of financial planning and goal setting. And you'll also see that it's a lot like vision boarding, which we're going to spend the next chapter talking about. Because dreaming big and manifesting it to happen is everything. What I want you to do is make a list of every expense that you have to pay every month. So there's your rent, your car payment, your utilities, maybe school tuition. And then add in the smaller things that you know you're going to be spending on too, like gas, groceries, dry cleaning. Do your best estimate of these. If it's helpful, look back at the past couple months of credit card statements to see what they've been on average. Don't cut corners here. The more you include, the better idea you're going to have of how much money you really need to be setting aside every month. Believe me, I know it's not the most fun to have to do this, but what did you think getting your money in order was going to look like? You can't be making it rain if you don't get your shit together first. Now that you have your list, I want you to add up all those numbers. The resulting amount is your do or die. Need to nail it bottom line every month. But here's the thing. Anything left over after you've hit that number and paid for every single thing that's on the list is not fun money. No, girl. 20% of what you bring home goes directly into your savings and stays put. Do you hear me? I didn't just get where I am financially today because I made bank and married well. A big piece of my success is that the money I saved every single month. So, don't sleep on your savings. Now, this next bit is crucial. Every month, I want you to track your spending and your savings. What are you actually spending your money on? Where do you tend to spend the most? Also, keep an eye on that savings account. From month to month, hopefully you'll see that balance grow. But you're not just going to sit back and wait for that little sapling of a number to grow into a big-ass tree. No, you're going to throw some turbocharged fertilizer on that shit. And the way you're going to do that is this. Pick a goal. I'm a major believer that setting a goal is one of the best ways to align your mind and your actions, which I'll be teaching you in the next chapter. For now, suffice it to say that by picking out something that you want to save up for, you'll be giving purpose to this whole ordeal. And while, yeah, you could be making that goal a pair of shoes or new jewelry, I'm encouraging you to dig a little deeper. What would be a game changer for you? A down payment on a house? A car? A laptop, a class, or training that would get you closer to your dream job? Just make sure that it's achievable. I know I told you to dream big, but wishing for a $10 million house out of the gate is a little lofty and is only going to make you frustrated. And then every month when you see your savings, ask yourself if you're on track to hitting your goal in a reasonable amount of time. If not, you're just going to do one of two things. Or both if you really want to know what I think. One, you're going to start regularly contributing more to your little nest egg. I know it's not always easy to choose savings or sushi, but be honest with yourself. How bad do you want to hit that goal? And wouldn't it be amazing if it happened in the next few years and not 20 years from now? Two, you're going to think about boosting the amount of money you can make in the first place. If you're in a position to do so, can you challenge yourself to make more next month and the next month after that? Can you ask your boss for that long overdue raise that you know you deserve, but you just haven't gotten the balls to discuss? As you'll see a little later in this chapter, recognizing your worth and demanding that others recognize it too is one of the essential keys to boosting your net worth. Investing. I'm not here to pull a Leo and Wolf of Wall Street. I'm not going to tell you exactly what to do with your money, but I can recommend that you can take the time to get educated about where you're parking the money that you're setting aside. Because the next level of saving is investing, or having your money start to work for you. And by that, I mean earning more interest while it just sits and waits potentially for you to come and spend it on your fabulous goal. I know for some of you, just setting money aside in the first place makes you get Great Gatsby vibes, but there's no reason to settle for that Bank of America account earning you 1% interest while you could be earning more in your sleep. I started investing my money when I was 18 years old. I opened up an account at TD Ameritrade, and then I opened up an investment account. I learned that I could deposit the 20% that I wanted to save, essentially forget about it, and then ultimately watch it grow without having to lift a finger. And because in a lot of cases you can't move your money for a certain period of time, it meant that I didn't start itching to get my paws on those funds for something that I knew I shouldn't be spending it on. Because as good as I was at saving, I'm still a human, and an extra $1,000 just sitting in a checking account would have probably made its way towards a new bag. That's the beauty of having a savings account in general. You'll never be able to play that game of knowing how much money you can spend. It's there in your account balance in black and white. When it comes to investing and setting money aside, in my opinion, there's one clear winner: U.S. public index funds. But this comes with a huge caveat. You must promise yourself to not let emotions take over. Investing is a long game, and the real earnings happen when you hang in there through both the ups and the downs of the market. There will be a lot of headlines about the impending doom of a crash. Some of these headlines will play out, and furthermore, there is an absolute certainty that the value of your investments will decline at times. Do you have the emotional fortitude to not sell during these times? Do you have the confidence to politely ignore the advice of people who are fearful of the stock market? Also, pay close attention to the fees associated with your investments. A 2% annual fee might not sound like much, but over the course of your life, it adds up to a huge number because of the compounding effect over time. If there is a single strategy to adopt, it is to invest a portion of your income every month through thick and thin. It's called dollar cost averaging, and it works. Experiment with online interest calculators. The U.S. S&P 500 has consistently returned an average of 9.7% annually. This is an average, and therefore it comes with rocky times along the way. It can and will almost surely drop substantially for short periods of time along the way. But just as surely as it will drop, it will quickly rebound stronger than ever. Take a look at the charts and prove it to yourself. Pay attention to what happened after every decline. Now, imagine your savings right before a decline. Can you handle seeing that drop that comes next without selling? If so, you can be sure that you'll win over the course of your life. Can you afford to put $250 each month into a low-cost S&P 500 index fund? If so, by adopting this strategy, you're likely to have $500,000 in 30 years. When it comes to investing and setting money aside, what's most important is that you don't invest anything that you can't afford to lose, especially if you're dealing with stocks. That's not where you want your life savings to go. But if you have a couple thousand that you're hanging on to for a rainy day without super high stakes, work with your financial advisor to figure out your goals, your timeline, and how much risk you're willing to take. Never pay retail. On a more day-to-day cash in my wallet level, I've found other ways to save money. I do love to shop, and it's no secret that I have expensive taste, but I'm actually super careful about how I choose to spend. So when I do want to splurge, I always do it intelligently, which is where never paying retail comes in. I first figured this out when I wanted to make my first big purchase after making money in real estate. I had a rose gold Daytona Rolex on my vision board for years, and it was finally time to make that manifestation come true. Because I'd been putting aside 20% religiously, I wanted to reward myself with a tangible reminder of my success. But I wasn't about to walk into a store and pay retail for this $75,000 watch. Hell no, I'm not stupid with my money. So instead, I went to a consignment store. I'd been selling stuff there for a while because I had so many shoes that Mr. Valentino had bought me that I couldn't fit in my apartment anymore. And I knew there was lots of other people like me who'd gotten really special items as gifts or maybe needed to clean out their closets, so they were sending their things to the site. I started browsing for the watch, and sure enough, I found the exact same one for $25,000, a third of the price of a brand new one. And yet, this one was in perfect condition. It just happened to be owned by someone else. It was so exciting because I was able to buy myself something I'd wanted for a long time. I could wear it every single day and it would never go out of style. It wasn't any less special to me because I found a crazy good deal. In fact, it made me feel smart. And it was aligned with my goal of wanting to continue building my wealth, which I'd never been able to do if I dropped $100,000 every time I wanted to treat myself. I was also very into this scenario because it taught me about depreciating assets and assets that maintain their value. It's important to realize when you're spending your hard-earned money that there are some things that lose their value and others that maintain it. The reality is, those gorgeous Brian Atwood pumps start losing the value the second you walk out of the store. That Cartier Love bracelet, on the other hand, that's financially timeless. In most cases, unless you're buying couture, your clothes and shoes aren't forever buys. Jewelry and diamonds, in addition to being a girl's best friend, are investments. The other lesson here is what you're really spending your money on when you walk into a store. Take diamonds, for example. I started taking an interest in them when Mr. Valentino would take me to Tiffany's and Cartier and buy me little things like necklaces and bracelets, and I'd mentally take note of the price. Then I would go to sites like Blue Nile and look into stones and learn about things like color, clarity, inclusions, cut, and sizing. What I realized is that diamonds are essentially a dime a dozen, but places like Tiffany's purchase them and mark them up, sometimes as much as 4 times their actual value. Then, one day, we were in Van Cleef and Arpels. I pointed out a necklace that I thought was sweet, and the saleswoman told me it was $12,000. $12,000 for a few microscopic diamonds and some mother of pearl? I was blown away. I couldn't believe that people were paying this much for a stone that doesn't come out of the ground stamped with Harry Winston. Your diamonds aren't more special because of their name brand. You're just paying more for them because you don't know the jewelry game. Yet, I love when girls are showing off their ring saying, "It's 4 carats." Well, guess what, bitch? You could have had double that for the same price if your daddy did his research. My friend, who's a diamond dealer, verified my apprehension about how you don't have to spend that much on a stone. Her advice to me was this: always buy from a GIA-certified wholesale diamond dealer or trusted resale sites, never retail. Also, buy the best quality diamonds that you can with the budget you have. That's because not all diamonds are created equal. Get familiar with the 4 C's: carat, color, clarity, and cut, because each of these attributes affect how valuable your stone is. It might surprise you to hear that the size of the diamond is actually less important than the color and clarity when it comes to holding value. That's right, my loves. Bigger is not always better. But of course, there are those huge, fabulous diamonds with great color and clarity that are super rare. And those you never sell. You collect them. Now that you're looking to save money, think about how you can shop smarter too. Consider consignment sites instead of buying straight from the store. I know how fun it can be to come out of Barney's with all your bags, doing your best Julia Roberts down Rodeo, but you're not just paying for that blazer or trousers or dress when you do that. You're paying for the markup from wholesale, the markup from the brand or designer name, the markup for the store's name, and then the sales tax, 8.25% here in California. I don't know about you, honey, but I work way too hard for my money to be lighting it on fire like that. I'll save those for gas cans for an ex's house. How to spend. Growing up, seeing my parents live in this dreary life of restraint and sacrifice, I knew that I wanted to find a different relationship with my money. I'd gotten the savings part down cold, but what about the rest of it? What was the point of working my ass off if I couldn't enjoy the fruits of my labor? If I wasn't seeing the value of what money could do for me or the happiness that it could make me feel, then what was I really even working for? I wasn't about to go out and toss around all my hard-earned cash because the stakes were way too high. I had to make it on my own, no matter what. But like I said, I wanted to live a little, you know, sparkle. The first thing I had to do was retrain my brain to believe that I could afford things and that it was okay to spend money. I didn't know it at the time, but this is one of my early manifesting exercises. The more I believed I could spend, the more money I made to cover those expenses. It might sound simplistic, but it's a very powerful exercise and motivator. Because the more I enjoyed spending my money, the more incentivized I was to earn more. The first time I tried this out was when I was working as a model, doing mostly boring commercial print work. But I got paid $1,500 a day, which for me at the time was crazy money. Like over $1,000 just for being on set and having fun. To me, this was Gwen Stefani, B-A-N-A-N-A-S. I set aside my usual 20% and my agent's commission, but I still had all this money left. I was tempted to put all of it into savings because there was nothing that I needed. But then my imagination started going about what I could possibly spend that money on. And wasn't that the point? To make money so that I could actually enjoy it? At first, I thought I'd buy some new clothes, but I was always wearing them once and returning them. Another trick I've used throughout my life, especially when I was going on dates and shooting the first season of the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Then I thought about beauty products, which I'd had a fascination with ever since I started shoplifting eyeliner from the drugstore as a preteen. Side note, life hack. Sephora has a kick-ass return policy and will even take returns of fully used makeup if you simply didn't like it. Just beep, boop, beep, money back. So I decided to take myself to Nordstrom and went counter by counter, La Prairie, Chanel, YSL. I ended up buying some new products and a couple red lipsticks, which I could never have enough of. Because I was buying quality items that I genuinely loved. I not only made myself supremely happy, but I also felt like I was investing in myself. I wasn't worried about the splurge. I knew I could afford it, and it made me even more amped up to go out and earn money the next month so that I could do it all over again. Over time, I also got the hang of what I wanted to spend my money on, which were things I could enjoy over and over again, like shoes and bags, versus a bunch of silly throwaway purchases. Get bitchy. The next time you get paid, take out your planner once again and do your regular savings exercise. Put aside that 20% and any other expenses that need to come out. Rookie mistake alert. Don't forget to also account for the money that you will need to put aside for taxes. Then look at what's left. What's your play money? That's yours to Parks and Rec style, treat yourself. Ask yourself what would feel meaningful and lasting beyond just blowing it on something you won't even remember in a week. Think about items, services, or experiences that would make you really feel appreciated for all the work that went into earning this money. For me, I always valued my extensive and overly excessive nightly bedtime routine. In addition to my silk pillowcase and eye mask that I've never been able to live without, there's something so luxe feeling about slathering myself in a totally over-the-top nine-step regimen of overpriced potions and lotions. Every night, I would go to bed feeling rich AF. I felt like an Upper East Sider named Caroline who came from money, summered in the Hamptons, and wore diamonds in the ocean. Little things like that trained my brain to make me believe that I was that rich. Spend your money on things that make you feel that good. That said, not every month needs to be a shopping spree, and I don't recommend you spend every last penny of that 80%. Not to be a total downer, but shit happens. We know this. If every month you're ending up with a ton left over and going out of your way to look for things to spend it on, consider upping how much you're contributing to your savings. Could you get 30%? 40%? Then ramp up your savings goal to sweeten the deal. How to negotiate. Real estate is only worth what someone's willing to pay. Just like real estate, remember everything in life can always be negotiated. I will always remember my first deal as a real estate agent. I had gone to an open house and met this woman who was a fashion designer and ran this huge fashion company. And I was so excited to meet her because I actually owned a few of her dresses. She was looking for a real estate agent and said, "You seem sophisticated and smart. Will you help me find a house?" And even though I was just starting out and getting a feel for the job, I told her that I would be happy to represent her. She had no idea that I was new because I was faking it so hard it hurt. Boss bitch business rule number two, acting like I'd been doing it for years. And besides, I knew I was going to totally kill it. But what caught me off guard was all the lying that would happen when trying to negotiate with other agents. It would be no secret that a house had been sitting on the market for 132 plus days or had fallen out of escrow, and yet here were all these other agents being majorly shady. Or when my client had finally found a house she loved, the seller's agent called me and was like, "I just want to let you know that an offer just came in last night for over asking, all cash." Bull fucking shit. We knew that this house had been sitting forever and that they were just trying to play games. But my client freaked out because at the end of the day, she really wanted the house. So I said to her, "I need you to trust me on this. This isn't real. We're not putting in an offer because we're going to call their bluff." I knew what this house meant to my client, but I also wasn't about to let this agent turn the tables on us. He needed to sell the house more than we needed to buy it. I also knew that if there was another offer, which obviously there wasn't, but still, we could come in higher or ask for more favorable terms like a 14-day or 7-day close with no contingencies. Because I knew my shit. Sure enough, the agent called me a few days later saying, "Oh my gosh, that crazy offer we had fell through, blah, blah, blah." I said to him, "Don't bullshit with me. There was never an offer. And if we're going to do business, rule number one is you don't lie to me." He was shocked that I was talking to him like that, but I stood my ground because I was right and I knew it. I also held all the cards. I had all the leverage. Like on the show, I can Bobby Fischer the shit out of any situation. I'm always thinking 8 steps ahead. Whether it's in business or in life, finding your leverage is everything. Once you know your value and what you have to offer and how that's more than anyone else can offer in a certain situation, it becomes a lot easier to get what you want. That could be a raise, a better price on a car, a better price on a house, or better terms in a contract. That's why I recommend taking a minute before a negotiation to write down on paper what you bring to the table. Say, "Here's what I'm good at. Here's what I can deliver. These are my strengths. These are my attributes." That way you can stick to your guns and never waver. It's also important to take time to figure out what the other person needs in order to feel whole and what their pressure points might be. Maybe that car salesperson needs to hit their numbers by the end of the month, or you know your company can't afford to lose another person on your team. And I recommend being prepared to walk away if a situation isn't going to give you what you want and deserve. When you truly know your worth, then you'll know when an offer doesn't match up to that. And that's exactly what will become your leverage, that you're prepared to leave the table if it comes down to it. Even though it sounds strange, that's actually a very powerful position to take in a negotiation. Because when you're prepared to leave with nothing, then you feel empowered to ask for everything. And above all, trust your gut. If something doesn't feel right, then it probably isn't. How to sugar daddy. We can't talk about the quest for cash without addressing one of the oldest forms of investments that women have made in their future, the sugar daddy. Though it's important to point out that when I talk about sugar daddies here, it's with the full realization that a sugar mama is equally beneficial for the bottom line. No matter which flavor you prefer, I can't deny that the right relationship can be the perfect diversification for your portfolio. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, let's be honest. There are some girls who love a man or woman with money in the bank. Who can blame them? There's something really sexy about someone with drive and business savvy. Someone who knows what they want and goes out and grabs it. Someone who still lives by the chivalry code and sees it as their duty to take care of the woman they're with. It's called big dick energy for a reason. One of my first serious relationships with Mr. Valentino was a first-class sugar daddy experience. He got to have a beautiful woman on his arm, and I got to learn amazing life lessons from an older man while being relentlessly spoiled. But as much as we love spending time together, and we took on the world like a modern-day Bonnie and Clyde, without all the bank robbing, it wasn't all Bentleys and Bottega. His money, which was initially the frosting on top of a relationship with a gorgeous man, became more like a weapon that he used to control me. Because I was young and naive, I allowed Mr. V to chip away at my power until the relationship became completely imbalanced. Out of fear that I would lose him, I let him convince me to leave my job so that I had to become completely dependent on him. As a result, I gave up a part of myself too. That's why I wanted to impart this wisdom. If you're going to sugar daddy, you need to do it responsibly. And do that by following this golden rule. Spend his money, but make your own. Accept all the gifts, go on all the trips, get your rent paid, but do not, under any circumstances, give up the one thing that puts some cash in your pocket every week. I don't care if you leave your corporate position as HBIC to sell beaded friendship bracelets to your rich friends in your spare time, or if you scale your shifts back from full-time to a couple times a week. It doesn't matter what you do, so long as you can make enough money to cover at least some of your expenses. There's no magic number here in terms of how much you need to be making. You'll know it's the sweet spot when you don't have to go begging for an allowance anytime you want a cup of coffee. Maintaining that little bit of independence will do wonders, not only for your own self-esteem, but for your relationship as well. It will be your way of saying that there's no price tag for you and your time and that kind of unattainability, which to a man or a woman who believes that everything has a price is pure catnip. Meow to the pussy power. As for anyone who feels like they need to throw shade at your sugar daddy arrangement, don't listen to that noise. All relationships are based on qualities that you find attractive about someone, whether it's their looks, their personality, or some other it factor that really gets you going. So there's no reason why it should be out of the question that money should be one of them. No one thinks twice if you date a fugly guy who has a great sense of humor. So if keys to the Benz is your love language, do you. Just remember that while clothes, shoes, trips on the PJ can be bought, you can't be. Never let money make up for the things that make you unhappy or uncomfortable. And definitely never let it change who you are. They're called sugar daddies for a reason. They should make life sweet. Chapter 7. Manifest Your Destiny. I've always considered myself a modern-day bruja. I've always had powers that I could never quite explain. It was as if my obsession with Sarah Jessica Parker and Hocus Pocus was starting to brew a theme in my life. No, seriously. I've always been able to make the impossible at the time happen, and so can you. I would imagine the life that I wanted, even when it was so dramatically different from the life I had. And ultimately, I got it. Growing up, I never had new clothes, much less anything designer. I lived in a modest, simple home in a modest, simple neighborhood and was surrounded by people who worked the same 9-to-5 Dolly Parton style job their whole lives until they retired. I always knew that I wanted more. While other people my age were obsessing over petty school drama and living in their small, lame high school world, I was aching for bigger, bolder, more glitz, and more glam. Since I dreamed of becoming an actress in Hollywood, I would spoon-feed myself a steady diet of movies starring the baddest bitches of all time. Marilyn, Audrey, Elizabeth. They'd enter a room, hair perfectly set, makeup on point, dripping in diamonds, draped in silk and fur. They didn't just walk. They glided, sauntered, and swayed against the backdrop of opulent homes or ritzy restaurants, champagne flutes resting comfortably in their freshly manicured hands. Men were defenseless against that kind of megawatt pussy power. I wanted in. And spoiler alert, it happened. Way before Rhonda Byrne unleashed this secret, I was realizing my own magic and attracting things into my own life. It made me realize that if you think it and believe it, it will come to you, aka manifesting. You might think this is all a little too woo-woo, but I eat that shit up like the lobster and caviar I always used to order on every first date. Because it fucking works. That yacht I introduced you to in the first chapter, that image had prime real estate on my vision board the year before. My Vogue cover, same thing. Not to mention fabulous trips I've taken to places like Indonesia, Bora Bora, and Fiji. Regular jaunts on a private jet. And a fairy tale wedding to an incredible man. I'll never forget one of the first things I manifested. A Louis Vuitton purse. I've always had expensive taste, and there was nothing I wanted more than a butter soft leather bag with that unmistakable logo. By the time I turned 18, I decided I had to have one. But working as a bartender, I wasn't even close to being able to afford it. At this point, I had about $2,000 to my name. Coincidentally, the exact amount the bag I was eyeing cost. But I needed that money for all the mature things like rent and the Whataburgers from the 99-cent menu that I was living on at the time. But you know what? I went to the Louis Vuitton store anyway.
I figured if I couldn't afford the bag, then the next best thing would be to borrow it. My plan was to buy the purse, take it for a test drive, then return it. I just wanted to see what it would feel like to own one. Just get a little taste of life with all the luxurious trimmings. I brought the bag home and put it in my closet and on my kitchen counter. I stared at it every second I could for every single one of the 14 days that I had before I needed to return it. I didn't know it, but I was already working the powerful steps of manifesting. Imagining what you want to be yours and acting as if that's already the case. When I'd run out of time with my bag, I brought it back to the store. To my horror, the bitchy employee told me there was a water stain on it and that he would not accept it nor refund my money. There was no water stain. He was fucking with me because he knew I'd bought it without any intention of keeping it. He was flat out refusing to let me make the return. Being just 18, I didn't see any other option but to take the bag and go. I got back into my Ford Focus, placed the purse next to me on the